The trouble with efficiency is that it will merge away into excess. With what seems to me to be superabundance of convincingness, Mr. Simons then lugs another character into his little comedy. That it was all a hoax by a chemist's pupil, who had filled a capsule with an explosive, and during the storm had thrown the burning mass into the gutter, so making an artificial thunderbolt. Or even Shakespeare, with all his inartistry, did not lug in King Lear to make Hamlet complete. Whether I'm lugging in something that has no special meaning, myself, or not, I find that this storm of June 30, 1866, was peculiar. It is described in the London Times, July 2, 1866, that during the storm, the sky in many places remained partially clear while hail and rain were falling. That may have more meaning when we take up the possible extra-mundane origin of some hailstones, especially if they fall from a cloudless sky. Mere suggestion, not worth much, that there may have been falls of extra-mundane substances, in London, June 30, 1866. Clinkers, said to have fallen, during a storm, at Kilburn, July 5, 1877. According to the Kilburn Times, July 7, 1877, quoted by Mr. Simons, a street had been literally strewn, during the storm, with a mass of clinkers, estimated at about 2 bushels, sizes from that of a walnut to that of a man's hand. Pieces of the clinkers can be seen at the Kilburn Times office. If these clinkers, or cinders, were refuse from one of the super mercantile constructions from which coke and coal and ashes occasionally fall to this earth, or, rather, to the Super Sargasso Sea, from which dislodgement by tempests occurs, it is intermediatistic to accept that they must merge away somewhere with local phenomena of the scene of precipitation. If a red-hot stove should drop from a cloud into Broadway, someone would find that at about the time of the occurrence, a moving van had passed, and that the moving men had tired of the stove, or something, that it had not been really red-hot, but had been rouged instead of blacked, by some absent-minded housekeeper. Compared with some of the scientific explanations that we have encountered, there's considerable restraint, I think, in that one. Mr. Simons learned that in the same street he emphasizes that it was a short street there was a fire engine station. I had such an impression of him hustling and bustling around at Notting Hill, searching cellars until he found one with newly arrived coal in it, ringing doorbells, exciting a whole neighborhood, calling up to second-story windows, stopping people in the streets, hotter and hotter on the trail of a wretched impostor of a chemist's pupil. After his efficiency at Notting Hill, we'd expect to hear that he went to the station, and something like this. It is said that clinkers fell, in your street, at about 4:10, afternoon of July 5th. Will you look over your records and tell me where your engine was at about 4:10, July 5th? Mr. Simons says. I think that most probably they had been raked out of the steam fire engine. June 20th, 1880, it was reported that a thunderstone had struck the house at 180 Oakley Street, Chelsea, falling down the chimney, into the kitchen grate. Mr. Simons investigated. He describes the thunderstone as an agglomeration of brick, soot, unburned coal, and cinder. He says that, in his opinion, lightning had flashed down the chimney, and had fused some of the brick of it. He does think it remarkable that the lightning did not then scatter the contents of the grate, which were disturbed only as if a heavy body had fallen. If we admit that climbing up the chimney to find out is too rigorous a requirement for a man who may have been large, dignified, and subject to expansions, the only unreasonableness we find in what he says as judged by our more modern outlook, is, I suppose, that no one would suggest that bricks are manufactured in the atmosphere. Sounds a little unreasonable to us, because it is so of the positivistic spirit of former times, when it was not so obvious that the highest incredibility and laughability must merge away with the proper as the psi. A.M. Sup. Would say. The preposterous is always interpretable in terms of the proper, with which it must be continuous, or clay-like masses such as have fallen from the sky, tremendous heat generated by their velocity they bake bricks. We begin to suspect that Mr. Simons exhausted himself at Notting Hill. It's a warning to efficiency fanatics. Then the instance of three lumps of earthy matter, found upon a well-frequented path, after a thunderstorm, at Reading, July 3, 1883. There are so many records of the fall of earthy matter from the sky that it would seem almost uncanny to find resistance here, were we not so accustomed to the uncompromising stands of orthodoxy which, in our metaphysics, represent good, as attempts, but evil in their insufficiency. If I thought it necessary, I'd list 150 instances of earthy matter said to have fallen from the sky. It is his antagonism to atmospheric disturbance associated with the fall of things from the sky that blinds and hypnotizes a Mr. Simons here. This especial Mr. Simons rejects the Reading substance because it was not of true meteoritic material. It's uncanny or it's not uncanny at all, but universal if you don't take something for a standard of opinion, you can't have any opinion at all, but, if you do take a standard, in some of its applications it must be preposterous. The carbonaceous meteorites, which are unquestioned though avoided, as we have seen by orthodoxy, are more glaringly of untrue meteoritic material than was the substance of Reading. Mr. Simon says that these three lumps were upon the ground in the first place. Whether these data are worth preserving or not, I think that the appeal that this especial Mr. Simons makes is worthy of a place in the museum we're writing. He argues against belief in all external origins for our credit as Englishmen. He is a patriot, but I think that these foreigners had a small chance in the first place for hospitality from him. Then comes a small lump of iron, 2 inches in diameter, said to have fallen, during a thunderstorm, at Brixton, August 17, 1887. Mr. Simons says, "At present I cannot trace it. He was at his best at Notting Hill, there's been a marked falling off in his later manner." In the London Times, February 1, 1888, it is said that a roundish object of iron had been found, after a violent thunderstorm, in a garden at Brixton, August 17, 1887. It was analyzed by a chemist, who could not identify it as true meteoritic material. Whether a product of workmanship like human workmanship or not, this object is described as an oblate spheroid, about 2 inches across its major diameter. The chemist's name and address are given, Mr. J. James Morgan, Ebbw Vale. Garden familiar ground. I suppose that in Mr. Simon's opinion this symmetric object had been upon the ground in the first place, though he neglects to say this. But we do note that he described this object as a lump, which does not suggest the spheroidal or symmetric. It is our notion that the word lump was, because of its meaning of amorphousness, used purposely to have the next datum stand alone, remote, without similars. If Mr. Simons had said that there had been a report of another round object that had fallen from the sky, his readers would be attracted by an agreement. He distracts his readers by describing in terms of the unprecedented iron cannonball. It was found in a manure heap, in Sussex, after a thunderstorm. However, Mr. Simons argues pretty reasonably, it seems to me, that, given a cannonball in a manure heap, in the first place, lightning might be attracted by it, and, if seen to strike there, the untutored mind, or mentality below the average, would leap or jump, or proceed with less zeal righty, to the conclusion that the iron object had fallen. Except that if every farmer isn't upon very familiar ground or if every farmer doesn't know his own manure heap as well as Mr. Simons knew his writing desk. Then comes the instance of a man, his wife, and his three daughters, at Casterton, Westmoreland, who were looking out at their lawn, during a thunderstorm, when they considered, as Mr. Simons expresses it, that they saw a stone fall from the sky, kill a sheep, and bury itself in the ground. They dug. They found a stone ball. Simons. Coincidence. It had been there in the first place. This object was exhibited at a meeting of the Royal Meteorological Society by Mr. C. Caris Wilson. It is described in the journal's list of exhibits as a sandstone ball. It is described as sandstone by Mr. Simons. Now a round piece of sandstone may be almost anywhere in the ground in the first place but, By our more or less discreditable habit of prying and snooping, we find that this object was rather more complex and of material less commonplace. In Snooping Through Knowledge, October 9, 1885, we read that this Thunderstone was in the possession of Mr. C. Caris Wilson, who tells the story of the witness and his family, the sheep killed, the burial of something in the earth, the digging, and the finding. Mr. C. Caris Wilson describes the object as a ball of hard, ferruginous quartzite, about the size of a coconut, weight about 12 pounds. Whether we're feeling around for significance or not, there is a suggestion not only of symmetry but of structure in this object. It had an external shell, separated from a loose nucleus. Mr. Caris Wilson attributes this cleavage to unequal cooling of the mass. My own notion is that there is very little deliberate misrepresentation in the writings of scientific men, that they are quite as guiltless in intent as are other hypnotic subjects. Such a victim of induced belief reads of a stone ball said to have fallen from the sky. Mechanically in his mind arise impressions of globular lumps, or nodules, of sandstone, which are common almost everywhere. He assimilates the reported fall with his impressions of objects in the ground, in the first place. To an intermediatist, the phenomena of intellection are only phenomena of universal process localized in human minds. The process called explanation is only a local aspect of universal assimilation. It looks like materialism, but the intermediatist holds that interpretation of the immaterial, as it is called, in terms of the material, as it is called, is no more rational than interpretation of the material in terms of the immaterial, that there is in quasi-existence neither the material nor the immaterial, but approximations one way or the other. But so hypnotic quasi-reasons, that globular lumps of sandstone are common. Whether he jumps or leaps, or whether only the frozy and baseborn are so athletic, his is the impression, by assimilation, that this especial object is a ball of sandstone. Or human mentality, its inhabitants are conveniences. It may be that Mr. Simon's paper was written before this object was exhibited to the members of the society, and with the charity with which, for the sake of diversity, we intersperse our malices, we are willing to accept that he investigated something that he had never seen. But whoever listed this object was uncareful, it is listed as sandstone.